Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Betsy Stark, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. They are the Internet's secret spies, companies that follow you around the web and sell the personal information they collect to marketers. Privacy advocates say there's almost nothing they don't know or cannot find out about you. This hour on Point, the explosion of tracking companies on the Internet and what it means for your privacy. You can join the conversation. Are you shocked by how much personal information companies are gathering online? Do you worry about how they're using it? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York is Julia Angwin. She is senior technology editor at the Wall Street Journal and one of the authors of the journal's new series about online tracking and privacy called What They Know. You can find a link to that series on our website, onpointradio.org. Julia Angwin, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
I have to say that your series was an eye-opener for me. And for those who have not seen it, what was the revelation as you did this reporting? What did you learn about the state of the art of consumer tracking online?
Well, we were just trying to assess what is the state of tracking. I think most people are aware that there are cookies on their machines, and sometimes those cookies are placed by companies they may not have heard of. But we were surprised to find how pervasive this tracking is and how it goes beyond cookies. So we surveyed the top 50 U.S. websites and found that on average, each site was installing about 65 different types of tracking technology on our test computer during a visit. And of those, the majority were from third-party companies, not the company that you went to visit. So if you went to dictionary.com, we found on visiting 20 pages there that 234 types of tracking technology were installed on our computer, and more than 200 of those were from tracking companies.
So this is a whole industry that's developed to track what you're doing online. And explain to us how they actually do their spying. How do these cookies work?
So what happens is that a cookie can give you an ID, basically. So it's like you have a little ID tag on your computer. And then any time that this tracking company sees your ID arrive at a website that it has a relationship with, it adds that to your file. Like, oh, now we see her on a sports website, and oh, now we see her on a swimming website. Okay, now we see her on a goggles website. She must be really interested in buying goggles. So let's put a goggle ad in front of her. So they build these dossiers about your interests based on your behavior. What we found surprising was not only are there cookies, but there are these flash cookies that can recreate. If you delete your cookies, a flash cookie could recreate the cookie. The other thing is there's these little things called beacons that are actually just little programs that run live in the background while you're on a page. Those programs can see where your mouse is moving or even what you might be typing in if you type in a comment or something. So we were surprised at the intrusiveness and also the broad scope of the tracking.
And what happens with this information? I mean, let's use an example. I go on Expedia to book a vacation, and now you've described to me that there's this very sophisticated technology that is following me as I book this vacation. What happens then to the information that that these companies are collecting?
So it used to be that each company had to develop a market directly and sell that data directly to advertisers. So each of these hundreds of companies that we discovered who were in the tracking business would try to sell your information about your trip to an advertiser. But what's happened in the past 18 months is a secondary market has arisen for that data. So now, actually, Expedia is a very good example that Expedia can just sell that data into a marketplace so that any advertiser who wants to reach a traveler can buy you, basically, in real time, within seconds of you completing that search on Expedia.
You talk in the series about a company called BlueKai, and literally within seconds of me surfing the web or performing a transaction on the web, the information that I've used is for sale. Is there a marketplace for it? Are they bidding on it?
Right. So BlueKai is the biggest of the marketplaces that I just talked about, which are the people in this business talk about how they're separating the data about consumers from the media placement of the ad. It used to be those two things had to be bought together. So Blue Sky is really the pioneer in this data exchange market. So what happens is that they have a little tracking device on Expedia with an agreement with Expedia. And when you browse there, your data is anonymously placed on the exchange. It says, look, we've got a live one. She's in market for this trip to Paris. Why don't you sell her French things? And all sorts of advertisers might bid on buying you. The sad thing is that the price that you go for is pretty low. It can be like as small as a tenth of a cent.
How big is this industry? How much money is in play here?
It's hard to quantify, and we struggled to get a great number for that. But in general, people say that the $23 billion internet advertising market, that about 80% of it is based on this kind of tracking technology, meaning that the ads sold are based on some sort of knowledge of your behavior.
You know, we were searching for an analogy, and I think you did this in your series as well, about what this would mean if it were not online, but if it were actually kind of in the, not the virtual world, but the brick and mortar world. And this, I mean, it could play that out for us. I mean, this would be the same as if you went into the Gap to buy a pair of jeans and what?
And so then this is like somebody is basically tailing you from the Gap into the next store in the mall and then the next store and the next store and sort of compiling a dossier about your activities. And, you know, the one thing to point out, and I'm sure that the future guests will point this out too, is that obviously this data doesn't have your name in almost all cases. So it really is about your activities, you know. But they are following you around and creating a pretty rich profile of what you're doing online. Some people say that, you know, that as that profile gets more detailed, it can really only be you.
So, and how much ability do consumers have to manage the way that information is collected and used?
Well, it's not easy. You do have some controls. The first thing you can do is try to set your browser settings, your web browser settings, to block some of this third-party tracking. But most of the web browsers, it's not so easy to do this because they'll block certain types of tracking but not others, and they may end up blocking things you want, like the cookies that save your passwords on Amazon. So then if that's not what you want to do, then you have to put in this browser plugin software, which is a little bit hard, but you install something into your browser that can manage your privacy better. And those tools are pretty good if you're willing to download software onto your web browser. And then the third thing you can do is you can go to the ad industry has a page where you can, quote, opt out of all of these tracking networks. But you have to know that you're being tracked and then the names of all these companies that are tracking you in order to make that decision. So I think that's not what most people are going to end up doing.
And you were making the point that you become essentially anonymous in name only. Give me a sense of just how personal the information can be that that these tracking companies obtain.
Well, the story that we did about a company called X Plus One really illustrated this. So we asked a tracking company called X Plus One what they knew about various people just based on the person clicking on a single page. They didn't enter any information. There was no other data about them. And they were able to figure out a lot of things about these people. So the one woman who clicked, they figured out where she lived in Colorado Springs, that she was a parent of young children. She likes to shop at Walmart. Her income was about $50,000. And these were all estimates, but they were well-educated guesses based on the information they were able to glean from her visit.
And are you convinced that the technology exists and the means exist to actually connect the name to that consumer profile?
Well, it's certainly theoretically possible. Basically, there's a certain amount of data you need about a person if you don't have their name in order to uniquely place them in the world. So if you have somebody's birth date, zip code, and age, you can identify them most of the time uniquely. But even without those, if you have a whole bunch of lesser known things, even somebody's movie taste, there were some researchers who just looked at recommendations that people made on Netflix anonymously, and they were able to identify people based on their movie recommendations. So basically, if you have enough data about somebody's behavior, you can eventually place them uniquely who they are. The question is whether anyone is going to do this as a commercial business. Right now, we don't know of anyone who's in the business of doing this, but it's certainly theoretically possible.
And financial information and personal information, this is all part of the mix as well?
Yeah, we did find that, first of all, these companies are making estimates about your income and your spending based on data they buy from offline data brokers. So another thing that's happened in the past year and a half is the ability to match your online behavior with your offline behavior. It used to be that really this the world of cookies just showed where you browsed online, but they didn't have any way to place you in the real world. Now they've gotten much more sophisticated about matching your online behavior with a lot of what is known about you offline. And there are huge databases based on your census records and your real estate ownership and all sorts of public records about car ownership that they can use to tie those two things together. So that has become increasingly sophisticated in the past year and a half.
This is On Point. I'm Betsy Stark in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about how companies slice, dice, and sell consumer information online and what it means for your personal privacy. We're joined this hour by Julia Angwin, Senior Technology Editor at The Wall Street Journal and lead author of a new Wall Street Journal series on web tracking and privacy called What They Know. Joining us now from Washington is Mike Zanis. He is Vice President for Public Policy at the Interactive Advertising Bureau, which represents 460 media and technology companies and supports the growth of targeted advertising. Mike Zanis, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you, Betsy.
And joining us from San Francisco, California is Peter Eckersley. He is Senior Staff Technologist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a nonprofit group dedicated to defending consumer rights online. Peter Eckersley, welcome to you as well.
Thanks, Betsy. And of course, it may be foggy over here in San Francisco, but that fog isn't preventing anyone from seeing what you're up to online.
Okay. Mike Zanis, let me start with you. What's the benefit to consumers in this boom in online tracking and targeted advertising?
Well, certainly consumers benefit from the availability of free content and services, which, as we know, there's no such thing as free content and services, but they are paid for by advertising that appears online. And as Julia pointed out, actually, it was an IAB study from earlier this year that demonstrated that greater than 80% of all online advertising is touched by or influenced in some way by targeting or targeting technologies. So what we see is that this type of information is really ubiquitous and really providing that type of service to consumers. Now, the flip side of that is obviously it's an exchange of benefit to consumers, but we also, as businesses, have the obligation to make sure that we're meeting their privacy expectations.
And we're going to get to that.
Trust.
And we're going to get to that in just a moment. But Peter Eckersley, one of our listeners, has written in on our website and echoes Mike's point. Sam says, "I don't like spam and tracking any more than anyone else, but at the same time, I recognize there's a trade-off. Recently, I applied for a number of positions through Career Builder and got several emails for network marketing direct sales positions. I don't like those emails, but I imagine the only way Career Builder can make money is by selling my information. This is the price of a free internet." What do you say to that, this whole notion that free content doesn't really come free?
Well, look, I think there's a balance to be struck here. We're not arguing that advertising should go away or that advertising shouldn't be at all informed by what you're doing online. But what we're concerned about is the fact that you can have these logs, these records being created of the things that you do. You're not aware of the fact that that's happening. You don't know the businesses that are doing it. You have no relationship with them. But these logs are created, and they're kept more or less for an indefinite period of time. So what we're really after is some sort of a limit. There should be a period of time during which, okay, perhaps it's fair game to show me some targeted advertising, and then after that, the data goes away. I don't have to worry about the fact that it's leaking out there into all these databases and being kept indefinitely. And perhaps the other point that we'd make is, insofar as it ever does go into a database, you should have a right to know what that database is, and then to go in and take a look at the data about you and say, no, I'd rather you don't keep these facts. Please delete this entry in this database. So for us, it's got to be one or the other. Either don't keep it, or if you do keep it, you've got to make sure people have access to it.
Let's hear what some of our listeners are saying today. Dana is calling from Brewster, Massachusetts. Dana, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Betsy and guests. Thank you for taking my call. To me, this is the most logical or extreme of a culture, or cult more accurately, of crass consumption that is not only an insult but a threat to democracy. I am a citizen, not a mere consumer of goods and services. And the fact that they can learn so much about me just by where I go on the internet is frightening. And yes, as a believer in democracy, I'm very concerned.
Thank you, Dana. Mike, why shouldn't consumers be concerned? This caller is calling it a threat to privacy and democracy.
Well, certainly there's nothing more empowering than the internet. It is the democratization of the internet to allow people outlets, free access to content and services, more than they've ever had access to before, right? The tools out there to get your message out, to engage with your fellow citizen, with your government, internationally, almost all of that is empowered by advertising. So we can't draw hard and fast lines, right? Advertising is bad. It undermines freedom and democracy. That's simply not true. What I do agree with, then, what we've been talking about here, is finding that middle ground, which is why we've actually worked and taken a lot of pointers from the Federal Trade Commission, which is the federal primary agency tasked with protecting consumers and pushing through industry self-regulation as they identified the appropriate effective mechanism for meeting consumers' privacy expectations. The industry has stepped up proactively and has embraced that as well.
But it is a self-regulated industry for now. Let's hear from another caller. Michael is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. And Michael, you're in the business. What's your comment today?
Hi, Betsy. Thanks for taking my call. I have a quick comment and then a question sort of for your guests. I'm a business executive. I've been in senior management for several technology companies, most particularly a website hosting company where we hand hundreds of thousands of company websites and databases and other sorts of things, all hosted on our facility, all data that we provided, you know, the hosting services for to our customers. And one of the things that strikes me about this conversation is that it feels a little bit like this has been going on for an awful long time. I've been in the business for 15 years. The amount of data that was at my fingertips and at the company's tips that was given to us voluntarily by customers with full knowledge of what they were doing, I think, was remarkable. And the amount of data that we could find without a whole lot of effort, even without paying a whole lot of money, was remarkable. These days, with Google Analytics and a whole bunch of other services that are out there that are available to people for very low sums, the amount of data that can be put together by, you know, for very small money is unbelievable. It feels to me almost like this is a great conversation to have been having about 15 years ago, but the sort of the horse has left the barn here, and the data is already out there. My personal feeling is that this sense of personal privacy that we're sort of talking about feels kind of antiquated.
Peter is our caller. Michael, correct that this is why are we talking about this now? Consumers have been voluntarily, he used the word voluntary, turning over this information for years now.
Well, it's true that indeed people have been turning over some information, perhaps large amounts of information. That amount's growing. Now, the thing that's going to happen, I think, is that people are just starting to realize what's been happening. It takes society a while to adjust to this amazing new technology, the internet that we're all using, and to work out what the right rules of the road are for this new technology. Now, I think the reality is that the average person on the street isn't actually at all comfortable with the existing practices out there in the industry if they find out about them. And so all you need to do is go and tell someone what's happening to their data, and they'll look back at you at horror, and you know they won't believe you for a moment, but if you go and show them, they're actually not okay with the amount of tracking that's happening. And the reality is a lot of this tracking is covert. You don't know who's learning what about you. And in fact, the thing that's changed, perhaps the reason why this is starting to be a political issue, is that as advertising becomes more targeted, that's the first time that ordinary people have any kind of window into these databases that have existed for a while. And I think that as that happens, suddenly you're going to start seeing more and more political backlash.
Julia Angwin from the Wall Street Journal, who wrote this series on what internet tracking companies know about us. What's your sense of how aware the broad online public is about the pervasiveness of these tracking techniques?
Well, I think that our caller is right, that there are some people for whom this is completely old news, and those are mostly people in the tech industry. But the vast majority of the readers we've heard from, like a vast majority, 90% or more, have been shocked by this. And I think that this really goes to the question of what we need a public debate about this, because I think some people in the industry believe that consumers have consented to give up their data in exchange for free content. But from our experience, it seems that a lot of the consumers are not aware that they have made that transaction or they're engaging in that transaction. And some of them would rather not engage in that transaction.
Well, let's broaden this debate and bring in another caller. John is calling from Omaha, Nebraska. John, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to literally express my gratitude for this conversation. I work inside of a financial institution, and it's such that, you know, we give a brochure out on consumer privacy, and it's very apparent inside of the face-to-face business world that the consumer is being protected. I suppose it's starting to turn a corner to where this conversation is being broken open, and the consumer needs to know. At the end of the day, we need to know how much information we're putting out there is being made into a composite, because if I, as an individual, could go online and grab a $5 or $10 people search, or said company that doesn't have my authorization can grab even more than what I can get myself, somebody needs to step in and protect the consumer and essentially create a filter. Create a filter and also let the consumer know so that they can become a little bit more careful with their behaviors and things of that nature if they're not allowing it. So I think this type of stuff needs to come out front a little bit more and stop being the, you know, a backbone piece to the marketing directive. And again, I just appreciate that we're having this conversation, because I've been talking with a couple of folks that are in the tech sector that are friends of mine, and they are concerned about it and have been for some time.
Well, John, we thank you for your call. Mike, to that point, I mean, can you guarantee our listeners who may have sensitive financial or medical histories that a prospective employer, for example, won't be able to get their hands on it?
Sure. The reality is that doesn't occur today in the online space, and that there are certain regulations as well as self-regulations to help protect that.
What does not occur today?
Information such as collecting sensitive medical or health information and sharing that with you know, an insurance company, for instance, or an employer. Those things would most likely fall under existing laws that are sectoral in nature that regulate the use and collection and distribution of those types of information. Moreover, the industry doesn't have interest in collecting that type of information, and we've self-regulated and prohibited that type of information from being used for advertising purposes for more than a decade through the Network Advertising Initiative. So it's not happening today, and we'll continue to be vigilant to make sure it doesn't happen tomorrow.
Peter, does that give you comfort?
Not entirely. I think that there are certain extreme examples, perhaps a diagnosis, where advertisers may try to put some effort in to prevent your insurance company or your employer from figuring out what what conditions you're researching online. But, you know, at the same time, I hear rumors, I hear stories from people saying, actually, somehow my insurance company did know that I'd been doing that. Now, maybe that didn't happen through an advertiser, but we do hear that insurance companies are not ignorant and unaware and uninterested in the possibilities of using the modern web with all its bells and whistles to learn things about their customers. And aside from those extreme examples, I think the one that we're more afraid of, perhaps in an everyday sense, is your employer finding out that you're looking for a new job. Those kinds of cases, the fact that you're in the market for a new job is exactly the kind of thing that these online advertisers are distributing. That's the fact they want to target you on. But it might be very sensitive with respect to your current employer.
Let's go to Leah, who's calling from Aiken, South Carolina. Leah, what's your comment today?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I see you guys always focusing right now on consumers and financial information, but I see a broader issue with freedom of speech on the internet, where out in the world we have freedom of speech, but we don't speak freely for fear of offending. But on the internet, people have the freedom to express themselves in all types of ways. And with this data tracking, I can see it becoming a huge problem of the thought police shutting down people because of this tracking. I mean, the government wants to be able to take control of the internet whenever they feel threatened by whatever outside force. And I see a huge problem with the thought police in this data tracking.
Julia, can you give us some perspective on that caller's comment?
Well, it is an issue that we looked into and we're still looking into, because it is worrying that you might be tagged in your profile as having a certain type of view, and that view would travel with you in your profile. So you would always see ads, or you would experience the internet in a way that was reflected back at you based on them already knowing you have a point of view. And so we already are seeing that with medical conditions. We were talking about this earlier, that definitely if you research a medical condition, including some pretty sensitive ones like bipolar, or if you're anorexic and you're looking at weight loss things, then you're going to be reinforced with messages that treat you everywhere you go as a bipolar person or anorexic or a Democrat. And so this is going to change our experience of the internet, where you're already identified before you arrive somewhere. And it does take away this idea that the internet is a place for common experience, for people to share an experience together anonymously. And that's really a lot of what we consider freedom of speech.
And Mike Zanis, how do you respond to that? That's certainly, you know, something that gives you pause to hear that information that personal and that compromising could follow you everywhere you go and make your life very difficult and expose you where you don't want to be exposed.
Well, I hope we'll focus on real world examples and not theoretical examples such as the one that Peter posited. And I'm not sure about sort of a bipolar example, but I can speak specifically. I know if I go to a search engine and I type in, you know, cancer treatment or something like that, I certainly want to get a paid search result from the Johns Hopkins, you know, cancer research. That's going to be a positive to consumers.
This is On Point. I'm Betsy Stark in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the intrusive new ways companies track your behavior online and the erosion of consumer privacy on the internet. We're joined this hour by Julia Angwin, Senior Technology Editor at The Wall Street Journal. And from Washington, we're joined by Mike Zanis, Vice President of Public Policy for the Interactive Advertising Bureau and Industry Trade Group. From San Francisco, we're joined by Peter Eckersley. He's Senior Staff Technologist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a nonprofit organization dedicated to defending consumer rights online. And Mike, I want to come back to a point that you were making before the break, which is to talk about the most typical examples of how this consumer information is used. What would you say is the typical use of the information that is collected online? What kind of information is being tracked, and how is it being used typically?
Well, primarily, and again, this actually is not a new technology or even a new technique online. Ad networks, for instance, have been around for 15 years, as one of your earlier callers identified. But the most typical use would be where a third party, let's say an ad network, has a presence, a business relationship with a website, and they'll have hundreds or thousands of these. Where they are present, they will be able to know which sites you're on, and they will create a profile. They'll say, well, we believe this person likes to travel. This person may be in the market to buy a car or a minivan specifically, and they'll try to serve a relevant ad to you. It's not like the example that we began the show with, which is somebody walking around with a clipboard around the mall following you from store to store. That's actually a fairly bad analogy. It's closer akin to if you went into the Gap, as your example was, and then I left the Gap and I went next door to the Baby Gap, and somebody picked up the phone and called the Gap and said, hey, we have a business relationship. Somebody, a male, middle-aged, with a blue shirt just walked in. Do you think I should try to sell them, you know, baby shoes or something else?
Peter Eckersley, do you agree with that? That what we're really talking about most often is, and in the biggest picture way, is the evolution of advertising to a targeted sell. So if I'm a new mom, I'm going to hear about great deals on formula and diapers, and my time isn't going to be wasted with ads for video games. I mean, isn't this largely progress?
Well, Betsy, unfortunately, I think that's not exactly what's going on. And Mike's point is correct on one hand, in the sense that usually what the advertiser gets to see about you is this sort of generic profile, you know, new mother, living in this zip code, a few abstract kinds of things. But along the way to getting that profile information, there are all these little beacons, these little tracking websites that are doing the literal equivalent of following you around with you know, the guy with the trench coat, recording all the URLs that you're going to and how you're interacting with them. And so there's that very intrusive profile that's collected at one step. And then, if you like, that's all sort of shipped back to headquarters, back to the database.
Well, let's hear from one of our callers who may have some perspective on this point. Tom is calling from Boston. Welcome to On Point, Tom.
Thank you, Betsy. Thank you for taking my call. First, I'd like to express the gratitude for what BUR is doing to bring this to, you know, everybody's knowledge, and also to the great things that the Electronic Frontier Foundation is doing for all of us in this regard. I think that as much as I appreciate the conversation, you're focusing on technologies that the user inherently accepts into their browsers, such as cookies and so forth. But I think what the EFF has brought to our attention, and maybe your esteemed guest from there could talk about that more than I could, is that browsers leave a fingerprint behind them. And as much as my voice on the radio right now is not really a unique identifier, but pretty much... for me, my browser, when I visit a site and the browser asks for a certain page, the browser also transmits information on my screen resolution, the fonts that are installed and so on. And all that is data that is not intended to identify myself, but to help the server on the other side give me a page that would fit the display that I could support. This information is pretty much unique. When I ran a few of my browsers, I discovered that no one else out of the millions of people that ran their profiles have had a profile like mine. This involves the fonts that are installed on my computer, my Flash version, the version of my browser with a very specific subversion, and so on and so forth.
Well, Tom, you make an interesting point. And Julia, I wonder if you would address that, this notion that maybe the answer to this, issue that's been generated by the rise of a new technology is another new technology that can help consumers eliminate their fingerprints online.
Well, yeah, I think that's a very interesting topic. I mean, we found that, you know, there's so many of these tracking tags on most websites that a lot of websites are having issues with load time. It takes a long time for them to load the page because there's so many tags. So there's been a movement to consolidate tags or even move to a different type of tracking. And this browser fingerprinting issue is one of many types of tracking that could be used in the future because it people are, the technology is evolving such that you can identify someone without a tag or without a tracking code. So then you as a consumer would have no visibility into what is being collected. And it does seem, at least from the EFF work that he's referring to, that some of these fingerprints can be extremely unique. So that could be the next wave of tracking.
Well, Peter Eckersley of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, otherwise known as EFF, Washington is talking about regulating this industry. Is regulation what this industry needs?
Well, it could help if it was designed the right way. Obviously, the devil is in the details with any kind of regulation, but the kinds of things we'd be looking for that would be helpful would be a genuine opt out that you can have. If you opt out, then this data, it's not just that the targeted ads stop coming, but actually the data is no longer collected about you once you opt out. That would be one important principle. Another would be some kind of limit on how long information about you can be kept for without essentially any genuine knowledge and genuinely informed consent or control on your part. Those are the kinds of principles that could form the basis of a good regulatory response that would be helpful. The other thing, I guess, that we could look for from Washington would be better incentives for the development of privacy-enhancing technologies. Because right now, those technologies do exist. There are, for instance, things like AdBlock Plus that you can install or NoScript. They're very helpful, but they're often hard to use, and they're genuinely many steps, years perhaps even behind the state of the art in the tracking industry. And so what we'd like to see is perhaps more economic incentive for people who want to defend themselves, more incentive to provide them with good technologies they can use.
Let's hear from another caller. David is calling from Williamstown, Massachusetts, on this issue of regulation. David, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Betsy. My comment is in regard to touching upon the subject of democracy and empowerment that seems to be advanced by the Internet. Your caller from California may know an organization out there called the International Forum on Globalization, and there's a fellow in a leadership position out there named Jerry Mander. And he said over 10 years ago that while the Internet is a good thing to use, that never forget that it enables people who are in control of it to transfer billions of dollars at the touch of a keystroke, while it enables you to do some sort of organizing, so your empowerment is somewhat misleading. So I think definitely there needs to be regulating. I think there actually should be a warning. And I wonder if we're so far behind the curve on this and so misled as the public that this is empowering that we'll never catch up and be safe on the Internet.
Thank you for your comment, David. Mike, you've been talking about self-regulation for the industry, which to a lot of consumers is going to sound like, trust me. Consumers have been burned by the trust me line before. Why should they believe that self-regulation is going to work out for them and protect them this time?
Sure, and it's a legitimate question, Betsy. One thing that the Wall Street Journal article did a very good job about, their whole series, is bifurcating the issue of privacy away from things like identity theft, right, data security. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about online privacy. And in this area, as I stated before, the industry has a long history of self-regulation and partnering with the Federal Trade Commission back over a decade ago to create the Network Advertising Initiative. Now, obviously, we need to go further, and as the industry has developed and innovated, so too has our self-regulatory programs, which is why we've been standing up a much broader, much more detailed self-regulatory program over the last year and a half, again, taking advice from the FTC, which has identified self-regulation as the best means for regulating this space.
Peter, can we trust the federal government to get regulation right?
Well, I think it's... The question is it great to have the federal government writing these regulations? It isn't. The question is it better to have the federal government stepping in and trying to lay down some rules than it is to basically have kind of almost a free-for-all, not quite a free-for-all, something in between those two, which is the situation we have right now, where basically the chief limit on the practices within this industry are you know, the danger of exposure, the danger that the Wall Street Journal will print a story about your practices and that will look bad. And unfortunately, I mean, just so much of what happens in this industry happens behind closed doors, you know, in databases, in data centers that we can't look into, that, you know, I think we're better off with the federal government if they can write good rules. We're better off with them doing that.
Julia, is it fair to call this a free-for-all at this point?
It is, actually. I mean, the self-regulatory guidelines apply to about 50 companies, but we identified, just in our survey of 50 websites, more than 100 companies in this space. So it doesn't, not all the companies in this space have agreed to the self-regulatory guidelines. And the industry initiative is going to show you a little icon on an ad that will tell you who placed the ad and the name of that tracking company. But I think that information is not going to be that useful to customers. They've never heard of these companies. What would be more useful is if they said, here's why you're seeing this ad is because we think you're bipolar. If we're wrong, tell us. And so I think that there's a little bit further to go for the self-regulatory thing to really address what consumers are looking for.
So you're...
Betsy, can I actually just address that, since IAB is one of the primary members of the steering committee of this broad self-regulatory program?
Go ahead, Mike.
I just want to... Two quick points. One is that our coalition actually covers more than 5,000 companies, and all of whom will come under the auspices of this self-regulatory program. So it will be very broad, cover the entire ecosystem. And, of course, we need to do better as on explaining our practices to consumers. That's a second point that none of us disagree. Everybody on the phone agrees. Notice has to be better, which is the idea of a ubiquitous, understandable, easily discoverable icon in ads that are actually targeted. And so explaining to them what the data practices are and then a simple one-click opt-out is also what we're pushing.
Would that satisfy you, Peter, a simple one-click opt-out?
I think that would be part of a good solution. It has to be. There's a very important difference to be drawn between two kinds of opt-out. There's one kind of opt-out, which is we'll put a cookie on your computer saying you've opted out, and then while we see that cookie on your computer, we won't show you any more targeted ads. Because if it's that kind of opt-out, then there are two big problems with it. One is that the most privacy-conscious people actually go around and delete their cookies on a regular basis, so in order to try and prevent themselves from being tracked. So it actually becomes impossible to opt out if you're particularly concerned with protecting your privacy. So we need good standards for signaling when you've opted out, and the industry needs to get on board with the web browser companies and the public interest community in order to define how you make that one simple statement, I opt out, and it stays true. And the second thing that needs to happen is we need to make sure that opt-outs cover collection and not just the use of the data.
Julia, as a number of our callers have pointed out today, the genie's out of the bottle. So my question to you is, can regulators put it back in, and can they stay ahead of enterprising innovators? Because whatever is the regulation today, there may be a way to innovate around it. That's certainly been the experience in business for a long time.
Yeah, that's very true, that it's very hard to stay ahead of this industry, which is moving at light speed. I don't know if you guys had a chance to see the article we had in the Wall Street Journal this morning about Google, but they are having all sorts of internal debates about how far they should go with tracking. Because if they really get into this area aggressively, they know more about anyone than anyone else. So it really could be a whole nother level of tracking. And so there's a lot of big questions out there about what these big companies are going to do. And I really can't say whether regulation would solve it, because it is fast moving, but it also seems like the current state of affairs is one where most consumers really don't feel like they have agreed to participate in this ecosystem.
Mike Zanis, a brief closing thought from you?
Well, I would just, you know, some of the numbers that have been thrown out, I would identify a couple of trusted sources that have done surveys and state that 2 out of 3 consumers are actually aware that their browsing information may be collected by a third party for advertising purposes. So there is a certain baseline level of awareness.
And the other is that consumers actually do want more relevant advertising. Again, a trustee study found that 72% of those surveyed said they would rather have more relevant advertising. So that's key, and we need to get this right. Balance is key. The industry has stepped up in a big way across the entire ecosystem and also addressed some of the specific issues, such as Peter's question about deleting opt-out cookies. We now have very simple browser plugins that harden the consumer choice so that we're respecting it over time.
And Peter, and I've got to give Peter a chance for a last word. Peter, just a brief closing thought from you.
Well, look, I think we want to make the internet a less creepy kind of place. At the moment, we're in danger of being watched, being followed everywhere we go. And I think the community has to get together and say, actually, the default should be, if I go and I read something sensitive, I do something sensitive, you know, I share my thoughts online, that doesn't end up in some database on the other side of the
all
world.
Right. Well, I want to thank all of my guests, Julia Angwin, Mike Zanis, Peter Eckersley, for an interesting conversation today. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Betsy Stark, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.